First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
In Florida and across the country, suburban women are drinking wine, organizing, and calling for a move to the center. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, how the women's organization Red, Wine, and Blue is countering Moms for Liberty. What are your questions about Red, Wine, and Blue? Call us up now, 549-2937. Then later, time to enjoy the music and excitement of this weekend's Jacksonville Jazz Festival. We'll have a preview. That and more ahead, but first this morning, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to announce his campaign for the presidency any time now. DeSantis has rode a wave of conservative energy in the state to pass laws on everything from abortion to guns to education. Hard right groups like Moms for Liberty, founded here in Florida, have fueled that support. Now, we've invited representatives from Moms for Liberty to appear on this program several times, and they have declined. This morning, we speak with a leader at the forefront of another group for women, Red, Wine, and Blue. Since 2016, Red, Wine, and Blue has organized suburban women across the country to counter what they regard as extremism in fights over masks, book bans, diversity education, and more. Rachel Vindman is the creator of the Suburban Woman Problem podcast, a Red, Wine, and Blue media property, and she is a new Florida resident. She's also the wife of retired Colonel Alexander Vindman, who became prominent during the Trump administration for standing up to Trump. We'll talk about that too. But first, Rachel Vindman, good morning. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to join you.
And what are your questions about Red, Wine, and Blue, folks? Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open. So as I mentioned, you are the wife of a prominent retired military man who got a lot of publicity during the Trump administration. And We'll talk about that. Is that what motivated you to start your podcast, The Suburban Women Problem?
Well, I was asked by Katie Paris, who is the founder of Red, Wine, and Blue, to join a new podcast that they wanted to do. I have two amazing co-hosts, and it just seemed like something that was really up my alley. I mean, what I love about Red, Wine, and Blue is how authentic it is. It's a true grassroots organization, and we work with real women, and that felt really authentic to me because I had been offered and approached to do other things, but I didn't want to do something that was out of my lane, and this felt like a way that I could use my experience and my life to be able to speak out. And I think, as we see, women everywhere are trying to plug in and trying to be more active, but it can be an intimidating space. And that was my experience as well. It's one of the things that attracted me to Red, Wine, and Blue and to the podcast.
Now, Red, Wine, and Blue is a network of suburban women countering what they see as extremism at local school board meetings and other spaces. Does that describe you politically as a former Republican who is part of this network now?
Absolutely. As you mentioned, we did just move to Broward County, Florida. Before that, I lived in Prince William County, Virginia for 8 years. I attended local school board meetings. After attending, Red, Wine, and Blue sponsors what we call troublemaker trainings with people. Kind of, it's how to be a troublemaker, but a good troublemaker. But it kind of just picks apart, like, if you go to a school board meeting, you know, what is it going to look like? What can you do? And, you know, how can your presence kind of counter the other voices, the loud voices that we know, Melissa, they are not the majority. We know this everywhere, even in Florida. They are not the majority. It feels like they are. They're definitely loud. but they're not the majority. So sometimes just going and showing up and being that presence that's not a seat that's taken by someone who's ranting about pornography and books can be an effective counterbalance. It shows the school board, hey, these aren't the only people that we're representing. These aren't the only people that we're making decisions for. And that kind of representation is important, that kind of showing up. So I have learned through my involvement with Red, Wine, and Blue how to do some of these things, how to have hard conversations with my friends, neighbors, acquaintances, how to bring up these topics that we were always taught were off limits and taboo. We don't discuss politics in polite society, but it's going to take, because of where we are and this moment that we're in, it's going to take all of us to counter the misinformation and disinformation, because it's a coordinated attack and it's meant to undermine our willingness to get involved, and maybe question things that we think are true. So, and they do that with, you know, just, as you know, just so much disinformation.
What would be an example of that in your view?
Well, I think, okay, we're just like that books, you know, I've attended school board meetings where Moms for Liberty, I don't know if you would say members, but people part of, I guess, maybe members, if for lack of a better word, would stand up and read an excerpt from a book and without any context about anything. And then if they're, say, their 2 minutes are up, it's okay, because the next person can come up and pick up where they left off, because they're literally reading things that they downloaded from the internet just to confuse and not offer any counterbalance. So I think that, and when you hear some of those and you're hearing these excerpts, you're like, okay, well, I mean, I wouldn't want my fourth grader reading about that, but that's not the age that it's appropriate. That's not the age group that it's meant for. And if, when you don't give that context, it can be frightening for parents. They're like, you know, I think everyone can agree, we don't want our children reading pornography in school. Okay. And, but they make it seem like that's what's happening, and it's absolutely not. So in addition to that, and I think what we're looking at in Florida, it's a big issue of book bans the way history is taught, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But what does that mean? And when you only let one side define it, it's very dangerous. So we have to be able to be informed and to counter some of this misinformation, because even reasonable people can be susceptible to the disinformation when there's nothing to counter it.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Rachel Vindman of the Suburban Women Problem podcast and Red, Wine, and Blue, the national organization geared towards suburban women organizing and pushing against what they view as political extremism. What are your questions about Red, Wine, and Blue? Call us up, your calls in a bit, at 549-2937. Now, Red, Wine, and Blue, Rachel, just launched a campaign called Freedom to Parent, 21st Century Kids. Tell us more about this campaign.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that, you know, the parental rights nonsense that's coming from the right is just that. It's nonsense. It's a lie, and we don't have to fall for it. It's freedom to parent is suburban moms, you know, going in the offense of the parents' rights movement for the sake of our children. So many times, politicians, they tell us they need cover. They need us to tell them what to do, and then they can respond to that. Now, I don't personally agree with that, but that's the moment we're in. Even, you know, Democrats, I think, especially Democrats. For a long time, no one talked about the book ban, but you saw in President Biden's reelection video, he talked about countering book bans. The White House didn't talk about book bans for a very long time, but that's what was happening in our communities. That's something that is important to parents. It is to fighting this extremism and pushing back. And now that extremism is going further. So we're saying, do not take this away from us. Give us the freedom to parent like we want. And that means if you want to make the decision for your child not to read a book, if you want to make the decision for your child not to learn this aspect of history, then you're going to have to find another place, not the public schools, because you're not going to mandate for everyone.
Now, as I mentioned, Red, White, and Blue is focused at mobilizing suburban women around these issues. Mm-hmm. Your podcast is called The Suburban Women Problem. Why did you name it The Suburban Women Problem?
Sure. So before the 2018 midterm, Senator Lindsey Graham famously said that the Republican Party has a suburban women problem. This was actually before, and he was right, but the results of that election certainly bore that out. But the problem, I think both sides have a suburban women problem in a lot of ways. The Republican Party certainly did and does have a suburban women problem, but you know, this is an elusive group of voters. We saw, for instance, the 2021 election of Governor Glenn Youngkin in my former state of Virginia. That was kind of a backlash to a lot of maybe COVID overreach, but parental rage, let's just say, born of a lot of things and a lot of, you know, misunderstanding. But it definitely, you know, had some foundations in COVID. And now I think people are realizing, oh, wait, this is not what we wanted either. Youngkin, this was not the answer. But we're trying to figure out what to do. And so much of that is, again, the stepping up, the educating. It's mainstream moms, you know, filling that void, because what we see is a lot of harm to our children, and we're trying to figure out how best to counter it. It's really mobilizing and empowering women and moms to be able to affect change. And I think we know what's best for our children. I think we know what we want, but it's getting those policies implemented. And again, you know, when you look at Moms for Liberty, I mean, it's not a grassroots organization. The term would be astroturf. It comes from a windowless room at a think tank in D.C., and it's very well funded. But even then, I mean, they've been able to get some national press, which I have to say, you know, quite impressive. But if you look at their numbers, you look at their involvement, and you look at what they've been able to do, it's not impressive.
Not to catch up, let me ask you, as a counterpoint to that, who funds Red, Wine, and Blue?
We are funded by donors. We are a PAC that is funded by donors, and we're also funded by regular people who, you know, give $5, $10 a month. We pay our organizers, and we pay them, you know, a fair wage. It's important that a lot of this work is not done for free, that women are compensated. That's a huge part of our plan, is that we're not just relying on people to come and spend hours and hours. So in the states where we're most active, unfortunately, Florida isn't one of them, but I'm pushing for it. We have organizers who will spend many, you know, evenings a week and sometimes during the day as well to kind of bring women in, teach them what we do. I always joke it's like an MLM party, but for politics. So we're not selling, like, you know, dip mixes or kitchen products. We are selling literacy on politics. We are telling you how to effectively change your community, how to get involved, how to have hard conversations. And part of that is, you know, compensating people. Mm. But it's a shoestring budget, I will say. There's not a lot of extra money, and we try to use it very judiciously, as everyone who's ever, you know, run a household or run a budget does. And I think that the effectiveness of it, of being able to work on that kind of budget, is because we very much believe in the mission that we are a part of.
Let's go to some calls now for Rachel Vindman, new Florida resident, wife of retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who came to national prominence when he testified before Congress over the Trump-Ukraine scandal. It resulted in the impeachment of Donald Trump. The Vindmans are now Florida residents. And as we talk about Red, Wine, and Blue, let's go to your questions at 549-2937. Joe is downtown. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I'm a mom here in Jacksonville, and I just want to express concern about the Florida legislature taking away medical decisions from parents and their doctors about their children. And this, you know, primarily is hitting parents of trans children. Most people don't have firsthand experience with that. But it's a decision that's very serious that parents weigh heavily with their doctors on, and the legislature's completely taken that out of their hands. And trans adults, I don't know, most people are aware that trans adults have had their medical care taken completely away from them in the state of Florida with the regulations that just got passed by the legislature.
Thank you for that. Rachel Vindman, I know Red, Wine, and Blue focuses primarily on education, but you said you're trying to organize in Florida. Are these some of the kinds of issues your group will be looking at in Florida?
Absolutely. You know, Joe, tonight we are actually having an event in redwine.blue. You can find the information, but we are having kind of an Ask Me Anything for that anyone, I guess, will be able to ask questions to parents of gay and trans children to kind of, you know, bridge this gap. Because like you said, I mean, most parents don't have experience with this, but we want to be allies. We want to understand, and there's a lot of unknowns. So I think this is going to, we're going to hold more events like this. I think this is really powerful. One of our first episodes in the podcast was we talked to the parent of a trans child, and actually a couple of Florida residents as well. And I myself learned a lot. But yes, pushing back on this, look, medical decisions should be made between a physician and a patient. And for a minor, that would involve a parent, right? I mean, I think every normal person agrees on this. And frankly, this used to be the Republican Party. It was all about the party of personal choice and personal responsibility. But now they want to legislate everything that they don't agree with. Then that's a choice that they are taking
Rachel, is that why you left the Republican Party? Did your husband, are you both now what, MPAs? Where are you now?
I think my husband's always been a Democrat, definitely. I mean, he never, I think, really voted when he was in the military, which now I think he understands the error of his ways. I grew up in Oklahoma, so everyone was pretty much a Republican, but I grew up pretty conservatively, just in a conservative community. And I always kind of held, I mean, it was the familiar place for me. But as I've educated myself, I mean, certainly our personal experience was an issue. But him speaking out publicly is just, you know, as a warning to others and using his, I think, his prominence now to warn. I mean, he also has a lot of experience in authoritarian governments, and he's a political scientist, so understands the dangers and likes to point those out, but mostly from an academic point of view. For me, it's, yeah, I don't have that deep academic background. So for me, speaking out and why I left is the Republican Party today is not the Republican Party that it even was 20 years ago, and certainly not what it was 30 or 40 years ago. So there's really no resemblance. And as much as people want it to be, as much as people desperately want to cling to this idea of a two-party system, that would be great. But that we don't have that option now because we have a party that's not rooted in reality. And there might be a few people who are still basically rooted in reality, but there's not enough of them to
Are you talking anyone. About Republicans who incorrectly believe the 2020 election was stolen from former President Trump?
Well, that would definitely make up part of the delusional aspect. But I mean, if you want to look at, okay, so former President Trump's followers and the people who want to elect, if you look at current polling, I mean, they're the majority of the current Republican Party. I can't quite understand it, but the polling certainly suggests that he would handily, you know, defeat any of the opponents that have so far entered the race. And that includes people who haven't entered the race, like Governor Ron DeSantis. So, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see what bears out. But I mean, even Governor DeSantis, is considered way too extreme for most Republicans today. Even big donors, we've seen the news stories. They don't like. They want conservative. They want fiscal conservative. They want to be able to keep more of their money. But when it comes to the social issues, a lot of major Republican donors are not willing to give to someone who is going to take away choice. They certainly don't want to get into this issue.
Like a 6-week abortion ban. I know you,
right.
And not to cut you off, I just want to get a few more calls on if I could.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Carol in St. Augustine. Carol, go ahead.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, go ahead. Turn your radio down, Carol.
I'm a former educator. Well, I still am an educator, I guess, in my heart. But I just really feel like this is a wonderful grassroots organization that you're speaking about. And also the fact that we really need to raise awareness of the need to speak up and against the oppressiveness or the result of banning a book, especially that is read, as she said earlier, out of context. I've been to many school board meetings over the years, obviously, as a teacher. I taught drama and theater. And the thing about it is it opens eyes of children who need to be exposed to other viewpoints in the world. And by giving so much power to such a few people, it's just absolutely anathema to me. And the other thing that I want to say is about the horrible thing that I just saw in a press release yesterday, that the Board of Education has considered publishing a list of books people object to, which couldn't even include algebra because it's too tough for their child. I mean, you know, that's maybe a stretch. However, there is a period when do we stop? And I do think marketing of this program, marketing of people who do have a voice, who want to have more of a voice, needs to be heard and not exposed on the media, but certainly spread on a broader basis. We need to be heard with the common ground. I know personally, having been a librarian also for a short year or two, that we do inspect the books before they're ever put on the shelf. And we do have shelves that are age appropriate, so to speak. DeSantis has raised this question, which should never have been raised to begin with, because obviously there's going to be a book slide by once in a while, but not the norm. And he raised questions where there should never have been questions raised. And I will take any comments off the...
All right, Carol, thank you. A listener has another take. Rachel, he emails the show. What about the books and materials provided by the governor showing completely age inappropriate material for school settings? Do you agree that they don't belong there? Rachel.
I trust educators. I trust them to make the decisions. And I know that there have been books that my daughter has wanted to check out from the school library that she has not been allowed to because it wasn't appropriate. As Carol just mentioned, this is definitely done. So just because a book is in the library does not mean it's accessible to every child. I'm an educator myself. It's been a long time since I've been in the setting, but I agree with Carol. Once you're an educator, always an educator. And I do know that is simply misinformation. And a parent can easily say, hey, look, this is just a subject we're not comfortable with. I don't want my child to check out a book on this subject.
All right. And last but not least, people are asking us, why has the Vindman family moved to Florida?
Well, I had to get out of D.C. and that was for my own maybe mental well-being. And we have very dear friends in South Florida. And over the years, is my husband's best friend from the Army lived here. He moved here when he retired, when he separated from the Army. And over the years, their friends have become our friends. And it just kind of made sense for us. He needed to stay on the East Coast for work. And we've always enjoyed the area. And, you know, we did not want one governor and a few crazy years to take a whole state off the table for us. A place that we enjoy.
I see. Well, last but not least, almost out of time, and I've asked you to talk a long time, so we'll wrap it up quickly. But you mentioned finally at redwine.blue, there's an AMA type event online tonight. Is that right?
Yes, tonight. Yes. And I mean, if you go on the website, you can sign up. You can, you know, we'll inform you of all our events. Not all will be to your liking or fit your schedule, but we have a lot of events geared at educating everyone. And take advantage of what you want. You know, this is what we are about, of educating people, of helping you have those conversations. And I just really loved all the stuff that Carol had to say. I mean, this is about, so many of the time, there's a kernel of truth, but it's used and weaponized in a way to scare people. And we try to take the fear out of that and help you be able to have more information to inform the people in your life who have been, you know, kind of victim to this misinformation and disinformation.
Well, thanks for joining us, Rachel Vindman.
Thank you for having me.
Host the Suburban Women Problem podcast of Red, Wine, and Blue. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, much more still ahead. Later, we've got a preview of this weekend's Jacksonville Jazz Festival with local jazz star John Lumpkin. But up next, how JEA is working to reduce carbon emissions, a special event at our studios this week. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, it's a community conversation about JEA's plans for this region's future energy mix. For more than a year now, leaders at JEA have been talking with people across the community to work on a plan to guide their electric system for the next 3 decades. We're having a special event here in our studios this week. It's called Adapt Your Utility, Your Future Energy Mix. Raynetta Marshall, Chief Operating Officer at JEA, is on the line now with a preview. Raynetta, good to have you.
Oh, good to be here. Good to be here, Melissa.
And we're so excited about this event. I think it's actually probably sold out or close to it. We're going to have a panel discussion with JEA CEO and other community leaders about this plan. Tell us about JEA's vision for its energy future and what we'll learn.
Oh, be glad to. We are so excited. We have been working on this for over a year and a half. And basically what this is going to do, it's called the Integrated Resources Plan. But really what it is, it's helping us to set and course our future for how we're going to supply the energy needs of the community in the long term. And we're excited about this because our portfolio or our energy mix is going to be more sustainable as we go forward. And we always have an eye for affordability, and we always have an eye for reliability. And so we are increasing, I'll call it, our clean energy goals. Right now, our portfolio is about 2% of clean energy, and we are looking at a 2030 goal of 35% clean energy. And so that is a big goal. We're proud about that. We have four other goals. We're going to reduce our CO2 emissions by 80%. And I think it's important, JEA thinks it's important that we set the example. So by 2030, all of our facilities are going to be 100% served by clean energy. And we're going to get to that by retiring our less efficient generating units. And we're also going to look at our customer programs. And as we increase the electrification of the grid, we're going to offset that by energy efficiency programs for our customers. So it's a lot of I'll call them big goals.
Yeah.
Yes. They are challenge goals, and our whole team is looking forward to the future.
And JEA and other utilities are looking at this steep climb to get to these goals. What are some of the biggest challenges to getting there, do you think?
So if you look at where we are right now, Melissa, so our current, we are at about 2%, 2 to 3% about clean energy. And so to go to 35%, that takes a lot of forces to do that. Part of that includes nuclear, Vogtle, and I think as everyone knows, we've been working on that for years and years and years. But that's coming to fruition in the next month or two, and then at the end of this year or beginning of next year. But when you talk about solar, that has to be built. And of course, everybody has been experiencing supply chain issues. So it takes contractors, it takes resources, it takes all of that to get there. And so those are some of the challenges. But we believe that we're up to it. And they're not goals for the faint-hearted, but we believe it's going to come to fruition.
Now, your CEO, Jay Stowe, has made this a priority along with you and the rest of the leadership team. How urgent do you feel this is for this community, given that, of course, Jacksonville is a very vulnerable city to the present and future impacts of climate change?
Well, it's important to our CEO, it's important to the leadership team, and it's also important to our board of directors. Who basically these are their goals that they have approved. But yes, it's very important as we look towards the future, and we always have an eye towards sustainability. And we knew that what we had wasn't good enough. When I say the 2 to 3%, so we think that this is important. But it's also important that this is a well balanced program. And so you're going to keep hearing me say, because, you know, people want reliability. They want, when they turn the lights on, that they come on. So it has to be a very balanced program between all three of those things, the reliability, affordability, and the sustainability.
Right. Well, that's just a quick preview of what we'll be discussing here at WJCT later this week, as we invite you to join our magazine adaptflorida.org and JEA for our community conversation about JEA's plans for their future energy mix. I believe we are at capacity, Raynetta, but people can stream the event live on Jack's Today's Facebook page Thursday night. So that's kind of cool too.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes. And we encourage that they do. We want everyone to participate. We're excited about it, and we want the news to get out there.
Check it out, folks. You can go to wjct.org/events and be part of our evening event Thursday, Adapt Your Utility, Your Future Energy Mix. Thank you, Raynetta Marshall, Chief Operating Officer at JEA. See you Thursday.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, Jacksonville author Julie Delegal has been named winner of the Eric Hoffer Book Award for Fiction for Young Adults for her novel, Scene. Now, Scene was inspired by a true local story, the arrest and murder trial of 15-year-old Brenton Butler. It began in this community 23 years ago, and it also inspired an Oscar-winning film, Murder on a Sunday Morning. Julie Delegal is on the line. Hey, Julie, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, and it's so exciting to see you get your flowers for your novel. Not only this Eric Hoffer Book Award, but you have received a lot of other awards for this story. And even the cover design by Hope McMath and Brad Kuhn of Jacksonville is getting some recognition, too. So tell us about Scene and what inspired it.
Scene was, as you said, inspired by the true story that happened here more than 23 years ago of a 15-year-old boy who was picked up by police, who was falsely accused of murder, who actually confessed to murder. And that that story really resonated with me as a young mother. And because I come from a police family, it really it inspired some conflicts that I needed to resolve. And the question that kept occurring to me was, how could everything go so wrong? And so I fictionalized it to explore that question. And all of a sudden, these imaginary people just sprang up, and I had to get their story down. I felt like if I didn't write it, who would? And there was a lot of homework that needed to be done in terms of writing characters who are outside of my culture. A lot of homework, a lot of enlisting friends and beta readers to get the story right. It's a fast-paced courtroom drama. It has some police procedural elements, and I'm just delighted it's been recognized as by the Eric Hoffer Prize for Young Adults. I wrote it for adults, and after some local teachers read the book, they told me, you know, this would be good for young adults. And so when I submitted it, it was sort of on a lark, and to have won this prize has just delighted me. And I would like to get the word out there that for young adults to read Scene.
Right. And this isn't true crime. It's fiction, but inspired by the true story. Did you feel that was a more accessible way to get the story out?
Well, I did. And I felt like it was important because these issues are so absolutely polarizing. The issues of police, mistaken identity based on race, wrongful incarceration, all of these issues have a tendency to put us in our corners. And by writing fiction about it, I found that I could get down to the human elements, the actual human interactions that occurred.
And as you mentioned, you come from a police family. Your father was a homicide detective. Your husband, Tad Delegal, is a former prosecutor. The case of Brenton Butler was so shocking in Jacksonville. And as I mentioned, it actually inspired an Oscar-winning documentary, Murder on a Sunday Morning. It shocked the conscience of many people in this community and sparked calls for police reform, criminal justice reform. Brenton Butler was 15. He was wrongfully accused of murder in this city. The incident happening first in May of 2000 when a tourist was murdered. He was falsely accused. And so that was over 20 years ago, Julie, but the same issues are just as potent today.
Yeah, our system, and as the daughter of a police officer, the wife of someone who's a former prosecutor, you know, my dad always taught me about due process of law and always believed in the system. And I think, you know, we've seen in recent years our court system holding up in some ways, in many ways. And I do believe in our institutions. But there are still some real stress points in our system where things need repair. And so this book explores what it is to go through a very flawed system. My dad used to say, it's a terrible system. It's just better than anything else in the world.
Yeah. You know, of course, Brenton Butler got lucky. He had some great lawyers who defended him. He went on to write a book about it, too, years before you wrote Scene. Did you ever meet Brenton Butler?
I never met Brenton Butler, and the people who were helping me publish this book and I tried searching for him and reaching out. I haven't been able to find him. I did send a note to one of his attorneys, Ann Fennell. The other attorney who represented him, Patrick McGinnis, is no longer with us, but they were absolutely phenomenal. And I, just like my father, have a great deal of respect for criminal defense attorneys in our city and how they step up for children. Another example of stepping up for children is the way that the defense bar came together for Christian Fernandez in our community.
Yeah. Shout out to, as you mentioned, Ann Fennell, who has really built quite a reputation in these cases. But at the same time, let's give you your props for Scene, which is available now wherever books are sold. It must be exciting to get this international acclaim, really. So I want to congratulate you for that.
Thank you so much, Melissa, and thanks for having me on.
Check it out, folks. It's Scene, author Julie Delagalle's book, named winner of the Eric Hoffer Book Award for Fiction for Young Adults, inspired by a true story. Not banned yet, at least I don't think so, in the state of Florida. So go pick up a copy. And Julie, always good to hear your voice. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa. Bye-bye.
All right. A quick break. But guess what? We're talking music. Jazz star John Lumpkin will join us with the jam session he's going to have at this weekend's Jacksonville Jazz Festival, a Memorial Day weekend tradition downtown. Are you excited? Some big names coming into town. We'll preview the Jazz Fest and play a little jazz too right after this. Don't go away.
Hi, join me, Dr. Joe Servin, for What's Health Got to Do With It, a weekly program that examines where and how healthcare intersects with your daily life. I'll speak with local and national healthcare leaders and newsmakers to help you navigate your most pressing medical issues. Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. is not the only country that's created a debt ceiling. Denmark has one too, but theirs is really high.
You really have to do something stupid to hit the debt ceiling.
Something stupid? Not on Denmark's watch. How a debt ceiling keeps the Danish government running smoothly and efficiently. Next time on The World.
this afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, known for her roles on the hit series Seinfeld and the HBO series Veep. She stars in the new film, You Hurt My Feelings. It's written and directed by Nicole Holofcener, who made the film Enough Said, starring Dreyfus and James Gandolfini. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Are you getting a good night's rest?
It turns out that just about any aspect of health is affected by how we sleep.
More than 50 million Americans struggle with chronic sleep disorders. Now, new research points to the risks we all run when we're at odds with our body's internal clock. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the 2023 Jacksonville Jazz Fest is coming up this Memorial Day weekend. Local jazz star John Lumpkin will be on hand for his own special jam session, and you can check it out. I spoke with him about the magic of jazz. John Lumpkin, good to talk jazz with you. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, Melissa, I'm glad to be back.
You have a lot going on, but let's begin with this weekend's Jacksonville Jazz Festival. You're hosting a special jam session. What's happening?
Yes, so the jam session is being held again this year. On last year, it was at the Vistar Breezeway, but this year it's going to be at One Enterprise Center, which is pretty much in the old Omni. It's where they used to have the jam sessions back in the day. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, this will be my second year hosting it. And I'm super honored and also excited because you never know who's going to come through. On last year, Emmett Cohen and Patrick Bartley, they were able to come through. And this year we have Dave Champagne that's going to be featured as well. So
this is Saturday night.
Yes.
Yeah, anyone can come out.
Anyone can come out. I have a couple of my students from the JL Institute that are coming out, as well as Douglas Anderson, LaVilla, Jacksonville Arts and Music School. Yeah, if you got your horn and you're bold enough, let's get it.
Yeah, they might need to work their confidence up to play with you and some of these other guys, right?
Oh yeah. But it's definitely a family friendly atmosphere. I actually took out, I guess you could say, the sign up sheet just because I wanted to make it feel more personal. And the results show, like, this is my second year actually hosting it. Well, going on my third year. And there's literally been like a line of folks that are just waiting, young, both young and old, just waiting to pretty much do what it is or what they do. And I'm happy to support it.
Well, of course, the Jacksonville Jazz Festival always attracts lovers of jazz and amazing performances. And it's happening downtown over this Memorial Day weekend. Just go to the city's website for all of the great acts that will be coming into town. But of course, you, John Lumpkin, are promoting jazz and performing jazz all the time.
Yes.
The Jazz Festival is a great showcase for you, but you've got some other news and notes to share as well, right?
Yes. So jazz is continuing after the Jazz Festival. I hear a lot of people always talking about, man, I wish we had more of this going on in the city. Well, listen, it is happening on June 18th. We are blessed to be able to bring in, along with the partnership of Friday Musicale, Mr. Dana Stevenson. He's coming in with his group, Dana Stevens, with his quartet. And then also on June 29th, in partnership with Amplified Avondale, we are going to be bringing in Lexi Hamner. And also, too, the beautiful thing with the Jazz Discovery Series, which is our 501c3, we're geared toward impacting the community with the next generation of jazz. And what that means is that it's a concert in three tiers. So we have our babies, if you will, with the Jacksonville Arts and Music School, the beginning generation. And then on the second tier, we have the JL Institute, which are young men and women that are looking to make jazz pretty much a form of their living as an artist. And then after that, you have the main artists that we bring in. So it's definitely something you could bring family and friends to. It's open to the community, to the public, and I'm geared up for it.
What do you love most about jazz?
Just the beauty that it brings of democracy. It gives you a voice. I mean, of course, it's birthed right here in America. And I think one thing that I really definitely enjoy about democracy is that I get to share my beliefs and where it is or where I come from. And for me, it's complete liberty in Jesus and what it is and what he's done for me. And I know that others also, too, have, I guess you could say, a different background. And I'm also comfortable with that as well, being able to listen to those individuals and hear where it is or where they come from. But just like I can hear where they come from, they can also hear where I'm coming from as well. So it presents a conversation, a communication.
So jazz, the musical form of democracy. I love that.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, we're going to hear a little of your talents. You brought a friend with you.
Yes.
Going to perform a little here in studio.
Yes, the Langston Oliver. He's been hosting many residencies at the Posting House, and he's finishing up his residency here at the Posting House at the end. Posting House at the end of this month on Sunday from 4 to 7. That's also open to the public. So we've been working a lot over here. So,
all right, let's hear it, guys.
Yes.
Ready? 1, 2, 3, 4, 1.
That's John Lumpkin and friends. For more, visit jazzdiscoveryseries.org and jlinstitute.com. And thanks for getting jazzy with us this morning. Thanks also to our music maestro, David Luckin, senior producer Heather Schatz, director Isabella Da Silva, with technical help from Morning Edition host Michelle Corum and Courtney Jackson today on Bones. I'm Melissa Ross. This is WJCT News. 89.9 Jacksonville. Have a jazzy day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.